Dear brothers, Namo Buddhaya, and Jai Bhim, especially to Vivekaratna. I'm so pleased that he's here for this series. And it's especially appropriate that Vivekaratna's here because in the next few days we'll be celebrating Dr. Babasaheb Ambedkar's birth anniversary on the 14th of October. April. And of course, for me, and I'm sure for Vivekaratna even more so, Dr. Ambedkar is a living embodiment of the Bodhisattva ideal, and himself prized very highly this ideal. I'm delighted that before the Buddha, from whom the whole Bodhisattva ideal emanates, that we have our own precious teacher, Urgyen Sangharakshita, and Dada Rinpoche, from whom Bhante received the Bodhisattva vow. We'll hear more about that in a little bit. And of course, Babasaheb too is here. So, before these three great Bodhisattvas, and in the presence of the Buddha, I'm going to try to communicate to you something of my understanding of this exalted ideal, which has been a very major influence in my own life. I'm especially pleased, of course, to be here at my old stamping ground of Padmaloka. I spent 12 very creative years of my life here, a lot of that time working as Bhante's secretary, which was more of an education than it was a work, if you see what I mean. Just seeing how Bhante dealt with things and seeing his way of understanding, his way of approaching things, has formed my life. And I was able to communicate something of that with my colleagues in the men's ordination team, as Padmavajra already mentioned, living in the caravans in the garden there. Oh, gosh, God, it's so easy nowadays. We were really tough then. We were young as well. But they were very, very precious years for me. And I'm very pleased indeed to see that what we did then has just grown and developed and evolved and is on a much higher level and much, much more full and mature than it was in those days. So I've been set this task of, I'm going to ramble, this is what I do these days, ramble about the Bodhisattva ideal. And I was thinking back to my own first contact with that ideal 48 years ago, believe it or not, brothers. In 1970, I'd contacted the FWBO as it was then, well, pretty much. I'd contacted Bhante. I wasn't really aware of the FWBO in central London, in Monmouth Street, in the basement in Monmouth Street, which you must all know about. I'd sat at Bhante's feet. I'd learnt meditation from him. I'd heard him speak about the Dhamma. Been deeply, deeply impressed. I came along for about a month, and Bhante disappeared. It wasn't ever quite explained what had happened, but I later discovered that what had happened was that he'd gone off to Yale University in New England to conduct a seminar there on Buddhism. And he was there, I think, for about 3 months, but he was replaced by Paul and Christine, who I later discovered were order members. In those days, order members went incognito. I wasn't very impressed by order members at that time. Enough said. I mustn't look at Madhranath, otherwise I'll laugh. But then there was talk of an Easter retreat. Must have been pretty much at this time, 48 years ago. And I went on this retreat. I was a rather timid young man. Daringly went off to a retreat in the Suffolk Sussex countryside, Hazelmere, a large Edwardian building that belonged to a charity that was looking after Tibetan refugees in Britain, Ockenden Venture. And the first evening, we all assembled, and there was to be a lecture. So I was awaiting Sangharakshita, who apparently had now reappeared, to give a lecture. It wasn't like that at all. He sat down, all of us around him, and a tape recorder was switched on. You remember in the old days, in the Stone Age, there used to be those reel-to-reel tape recorders, and they were vast. They were the size of a house sort of thing. And so this tape recorder was turned on, and Bhante sat there and listened to his own voice while we all listened as well, which seemed pretty strange to me at the time. And what I particularly found, I found it really enjoyable, that Bhante cracked up at his own jokes. And he really did crack up. He laughed and laughed and laughed uproariously. But fairly swiftly, the slightly bizarre sight of a man listening to his own talks and laughing at his own jokes was just sort of lost to me. I completely absorbed in the talk. It was the first of the series on parables, myths and symbols in the White Lotus Sutra. It just totally engaged me. I completely lost in the talk, amazed at the clarity of the man's mind and the richness of his imagination and the way in which he could draw out of what was, in a sense, a rather obscure ancient text such wealth of meaning, meaning that touched me absolutely directly and seemed to be speaking straight to my own experience. I was completely entranced. Over the next few nights, I think I only stayed for about 3 days. That was all I could take, as it were. As I say, I was very shy and I was on my own. I could only take about 3 days. And anyway, I wasn't quite sure what I was going to, and I didn't want to be brainwashed. So I'd given myself an escape route. But over the next few nights, these tape recordings were played. But after that first evening, Bhante disappeared. And we discovered later, after a day or so, we were told that he'd been extremely ill. And in fact, I overheard an order member, Gotami, who was a nurse, saying that he'd almost died. I'll say more about that in a while, but I want to say a little bit more about the talks, because of course they were my first encounter with the expression of the Bodhisattva ideal. The first time I'd heard the word Bodhisattva, the first time I'd heard what a Bodhisattva was, what it really meant. And although I wasn't particularly conscious of it at the time, as so with so many of the things that happened to me in those early experiences of the movement, they weren't very distinct. Everything sort of impacted on me and moved within me and moved me in very powerful and deep ways, ways I didn't really even accept or acknowledge. I remember saying to a friend at the time, yeah, I quite liked all that, but I'm not the joining kind. Here I am, 48 years later, fully signed up. I was pretty much signed up from day one, although I didn't quite acknowledge it. But you maybe recognise this, that you're not really that clear about what it is that's affecting you, but it does affect you. And all the different elements of what affects you are not that clearly differentiated. But in retrospect, I recognised that the encounter with the Bodhisattva ideal was absolutely decisive for me. I encountered the Buddha, which is what led me to Bante, and I found in my encounter with the Buddha, just through reading Edward Conza's Buddhist scriptures, that I found, you know, the teacher that I sought. I'd found the ideal human being that I so desperately wanted. And in Sangharakshita, in Bante, I discovered somebody who I realized only later, but I fairly quickly, effectively realized I'd found my teacher, my living teacher. But in the Bodhisattva ideal, as it gradually came clear to me that's what it was, I discovered the resolution of all the urges and aspirations inchoate within me. I found their focus. From so early in my life, I'd sought meaning, I'd sought value. I'd found myself so strongly desiring a better world, as well as a transformation of myself, a better me. The two were for me completely inter-involved. And as the Bodhisattva ideal became more and more alive for me, starting from those tape recordings, it became the guiding light of my whole life, and is to this day. So I encountered it then, not merely as an ideal, if you like, or rather, an ideal is something more than an idea. It wasn't simply an intellectual postulate or a set of theories or ideas or even visions in a narrow sense. I really began to encounter it in my early experience of the order and movement as something felt, as something experienced directly, mediated initially by Sangharakshita, but increasingly alive around me and within me. The Bodhisattva ideal is an ideal in the sense of something that lives and that one experiences beyond words, even as a kind of consciousness. But before I go on, I just want to communicate to you something else about that particular time, which does reflect on the Bodhisattva ideal, although I'm not going to spell that out for you. I found out later that, as I say, Sangharakshita had caught a very bad dose of pneumonia. He'd left the Yale seminar and flew out from New York back to Britain, I think just the day before the retreat began. And he'd gone with a number of the friends that he'd made at university, a number of the students that he'd befriended at the university, and they'd obviously spend the last evening out in Central Park. In fact, they spent the whole night out in Central Park. You can imagine what they might have been up to at those time. It was 1970. They spent the whole night out in the park. And Bante, who was a young man of 40 or so, had caught a chill. And when he came back to England, that had matured into pneumonia. And the retreat was to start. He'd committed himself to running the retreat, so he set aside his own health, and he just started the retreat going. But that night, apparently, he became very ill indeed, and he describes in a piece of writing that's well worth getting hold of, if you can. It's called 1969-1970, A Retrospect. It's available in Samizdat format. I don't know whether anybody's got a copy at Padmaloka. I'm sure there are some.
It's on his website.
It's on the website. It should be. Yes, I recommend it. It should be. There we are. But he describes how, in the middle of the night, he realized that he was on the verge of death. And he got up and he sat in an armchair And he asked the companion who was with him, Kevin Brooks, who used to live here at Pamaloka many years ago, to give him a stick of lighted incense. And he sat in his armchair in cross-legged posture with a stick of incense in his hand. Kevin became extremely alarmed. There was something rather spooky about what was going on. So he asked him why he wanted the incense stick. And Bhante explained to him that this was the way in which Tibetan corpses were arranged immediately after death. Panic. Kevin was extremely alarmed. And Bhante describes how, in his own experience, he really felt no disposition to live. As if the will to live had just gone. And he said he felt as if the scales of life and death were evenly balanced. And the two pans were exactly equal. And that it could have gone either way. And to him, it was a matter of indifference which way it went. Kevin, by this time, was very, very alarmed indeed. And was pleading with him, you know. And I knew Kevin very well, and he told me himself, he just pleaded with Bhante, please don't leave us. Please don't leave us. I need you. I've only just begun my spiritual life. We need you. Please don't go. And Bhante writes that it was as if a feather had been placed in the pan of life, and that gradually life began to return from that moment. Well, you can see, I imagine, some resonance with the theme of the Bodhisattva ideal, but I won't spell that out for the time being. Just when you do the puja tonight, when you come to the sixth stage, entreaty and supplication, remember. So, yes, back to me and my encounter with the Bodhisattva ideal as an encounter with a spirit or a mood, an atmosphere, an experience, an ideal in that sense of something beyond words, something beyond a theory, something beyond mere teaching, something felt, something communicated not merely by the words that Bhante was using, but even by his presence, even by the way he sat there and laughed very humbly at his own jokes. There's something about his whole presence that deeply impressed me from the first moment I met him. So this Bodhisattva ideal that was first communicated to me on that particular occasion has come through to me more and more strongly over the years. Where did it come from? Where did it originate? Well, of course, it originated under the Bodhi tree. It originated with enlightenment, with the enlightenment of the Buddha. I go to Bodh Gaya every year. I spend at least 2 or 3 weeks there every year. And I always spend a lot of time just sitting under the Bodhi tree. I try to get my nose as close to the wall, the fence around the Bodhi tree as I can. And just peer in at the place where it said that the Buddha gained enlightenment. And very often when I can sort of break through the awfulness of Bodh Gaya, which is an Indian tourist place of the worst kind, when I can sort of break through that and sort of tune into something that's emanating from that place, that Vajrasana, this extraordinary sense of something utterly incomprehensible that took place here, something that goes completely beyond our normal understanding, our normal experience, something that still lives, at least for me as a Buddhist, as a felt experience. It seems to come from there, whether it's, as it were, there objectively or not, I couldn't care less. But it seems to emanate from that place as something felt, a sense of connection with something utterly different, utterly beyond. And you could speak of as bodhicitta. Chitta meaning consciousness or mind. Mind in a richer sense than we usually understand it in Western sort of psychological analysis. It's sometimes even translated as heart, although heart, again, in Western understanding, is too one-sidedly emotional. It's consciousness, it's more like psyche, it's more like spirit or soul, even, you could say. You could say that, the soul of enlightenment, the Bodhi soul, although you'd have to interpret that carefully, understand I'm speaking poetically. So one at Bodh Gaya sort of connects with what the Buddha encountered, what the Buddha realized, what the Buddha became, this mind of awakening, this awakened heart, this awakened soul, awakened spirit, and a completely new kind of awareness. An awareness that, according to him, and according to Buddhist tradition, had never been experienced before. What I take it to mean is that even if it had been experienced, it had never been fully unfolded. I can't believe that human beings had never touched on that transcendental dimension before. And in fact, Buddhist tradition speaks of previous Buddhas and speaks of Pratyeka Buddhas and so forth. And in the early scriptures, you get some sense that the Buddha realized he was part of an older tradition. But according to Buddhist tradition, according to the Buddha's own words, as recorded even in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, he experienced things not seen before. He experienced a state of mind, a state of consciousness, a way of being conscious that was new in human history. And he, by experiencing that, brought it into this world, brought it to life in this world. So the bodhisattva ideal originates with the Buddha. I think when we speak of bodhicitta, it's not usually spoken of in this way, but I think this must be what it originally means. It means the mind of the awakened one. It means the mind that the Buddha awakened to, the consciousness that the Buddha awakened to. So what does it mean? What does the bodhicitta mean? What does the awakened mind mean? What was different about the Buddha's consciousness? There's so much to say here, and I hope that over the next days I'll be able to unfold much more of what it means. But perhaps the best way we can get at it is to start by looking at our minds and seeing in what way they're different from the Buddha's mind. So we're all sitting here and we're looking out at this situation from our own point of view, inevitably, because we're embodied. So I'm looking out from my two eyes, listening with my two ears, smelling with my two nostrils, etc. And you are doing likewise. Well, that's in a way not so different from the Buddha. The Buddha, there he is, he has two eyes, etc., etc. But when we look out at the world, when we experience the world, what we do immediately and instinctively, yes, instinctively, is we connect with certain aspects of what we experience as me and mine. So certain elements of the whole total field of consciousness are identified with. So You know, I identify obviously with my own body, and I privilege that the range of experiences that I think of as my body over your bodies. Sorry, my body's more important to me than your bodies. And likewise, admit it, it's the same for you. It's instinctive, it's natural, it's immediate. You don't think about it. We'll say more about why it happens and how it happens, but it instinctively happens that we identify with a certain range of experience. And identify with it in the sense of thinking of it as I and mine. Ahang and mamang. We ahankar. We make it mine. We mamang. Make it I, rather. Mamangkara. We make it mine. Mamang in Pali means mine. Ahang means I. So we make I and mine. Interesting, isn't it? Kara. To make. It's not that we discover them. We make them. So we add into the immediate perceptual situation an identification with what we think of as I and what we think of as mine. So I look round this room, and you know, I've got a long association with this room, and I can point to many details here that I had a hand in either choosing, or I was around when it was done, and that I connect with myself, if you see what I mean. I remember those beams being stripped and made attractive again, because it's just an old barn. I remember the ceiling being put in. I remember having the idea for this particular shrine room. It wasn't just me, but I was instrumental in it. So to some extent, I'm thinking, mine. And what have they done to my shrine room? Really, that goes on, doesn't it? And so I'm sort of identifying elements of my experience as connected with me and in some sense belonging to me. And of course, you know, I'm sitting here, I'm giving you a talk, in giving you the talk, I'm subtly importing I into the talking business. I'm trying not to, honest. I'm honest, Gov, I'm really trying not to. But inevitably, I'm thinking, you know, how am I going down? You know, are they thinking I'm really wonderful? Are they going to go away from here thinking, God, he's brilliant? And that's the best thing I've ever heard. And that sort of thing. Don't all rush to answer that yet. But I'm inevitably connecting I into this particular situation. And be honest, lads, you're doing the same. You're reflecting back on yourself, either thinking, God, I could speak like that. Stupid. Or, oh dear, he's so much better than me. Or something like that, I don't know what. But to some extent, maybe not entirely, of course, it's not only like that, but to some extent we import into every perceptual situation notions of I and mine. We bind ourselves up with elements of our experience. This is the way the Buddha speaks of it. We bind ourselves to the elements in the sense of the dhatus. Do you do the six element practice on these retreats?
Sometimes.
Well, some of you will.
We're very orthodox.
Oh, yeah, of course. But many of you will have done the six element practice, and in which you systematically disidentify yourself. Well, that is, you recognize that there is no identity in each of the elements, earth, water, fire, air, and space. And you're doing that because what we naturally, instinctively do is bind ourselves up with the elements, that is, with some part of the elements. I bind myself up with this bit of earth element, not that bit of earth element. With this, blood flowing through me, not with that blood flowing through me. So the Buddha speaks of us as binding consciousness up with the elements, even binding consciousness in the sense of thinking of it as my consciousness. So that's what we do. We seize upon our experience and identify with elements within it as I and mine. We bind our idea of ourselves up with those elements. We can speak of that also in terms of the skandhas. This is more conventionally how the Buddha speaks. We think of ourselves as being in the skandhas, in one of the skandhas, or being that skandha, or being a separate from that skandha, or whatever. But we think of I in terms of elements of our experience. Completely natural, completely spontaneous. It just happens. It started happening from the moment that consciousness began to become more articulate, in the sense of articulated rather than being spoken. Although speaking is a vital way of that identification taking place. So this is normal consciousness. Don't beat yourselves up about it. Everybody's doing it. It's as it were, inherited. It's what's bred into us. Bhante's even spoken quite recently, rather provocatively, on an analogy with the Christian notion of original sin. Please don't get worried, ex-Catholics. Where are the Irish? But don't panic. He's just saying there's something in that notion. Of course, it's not original sin in the Christian sense, but there's something that we bring into life which is the source of our suffering and our evil. And that is this inherited grasping of self. Now, we inherit it in two different ways. We can speak of inheriting it in two different ways. You can take, let's start with the evolutionary point of view. We can look at ourselves as the descendant, as risen ape, to put it that way. We can see ourselves as having an evolutionary ancestry, going way back to the warm seas of the primeval earth, when little bubbles of life began to emerge, and organisms emerged which were forms organized for survival, where the organism developed ways of preserving itself, persisting in its own being, to borrow a term from Spinoza. The organism strives to persist in its own being, to continue in existence, and in its struggle to persist in its own being, it develops the capacity to sense what is threatening to it, and sense what preserves it, and sense what can perpetuate it, a mate, in other words. So the senses develop as a way of preserving the organism's identity through time. At a certain point, sense consciousness develops intelligence, the capacity to abstract, to think I, to speak I, to separate in thought self from world. An animal even quite sophisticated animals, live in a sort of eternal present, simply driven by instincts of survival. But once one begins to be able to think, to abstract, one develops the notion of I, And that notion of I then gets tied up with particular features of experience. Do you see what I mean? I'm scrambling over vast areas of theory, which are probably sufficiently familiar to you to understand what I mean. So the organism, as a means of its own survival, develops the capacity to think, to use concepts. And those concepts include, as a primary basis, the concept of I continuing through time. So much that can be said about this. It's such an important process. But we're the heirs of that evolutionary struggle. Our notion of ourselves, this instinctive grasping onto self, has that evolutionary background. And so, as organisms, we instinctively cling to ourselves, because that is the way that evolution has, or rather, the processes of natural selection have enabled this particular type of organism to continue. So we're just given it right from the start without any effort. It's just there. So don't feel bad about it. It's quite normal and natural. It's okay to have a self and to be attached to that self. It's problematic and it leads to suffering, but it's okay. It's normal. So that's one etiology. That's one background. That's one means by which this self-clinging comes about. There's another means by which it comes about, which is, from a Buddhist point of view, the evolution through karma, evolution through repeated rebirths. And those repeated rebirths take place because of that clinging to self. So because we cling to self, when we die, that instinctive clinging to self seeks another identity. Tibetan Book of the Dead describes very vividly and very believably that the urge, the disembodied urge for embodiment, it's very loosely embodied in a sort of visionary self, but that that urge seeks a new identity. Seeks to be something. Very deep within us, this desire to be something, to be somebody, very deep within us. And it is what has led us here, from this point of view, from the point of view of our previous births. If we can believe that, if we can relate to that, anusaya. In Pali, the latent tendency to self-identity, to self-identification. A latent tendency. It's a very, very good expression. Anusaya. Sort of buried within us this strong inclination to be something. To be somebody. To know who we are as distinct from everything else. A very, very deep, craving. So it's an evolutionary urge, but it's an urge that we can also understand as being bred into us. In the Yogacara, it speaks of it as a vasana, the dvaya graha vasana, the perfuming or the influence of the attachment to the grasping or to self and other, mine and I. So deep, deep impulsion, the deepest impulsion within us to be an I, to have a self. The Buddha has lost that. It's gone. It's gone. His mind is, he says himself in his very first utterance, at least as it's recorded, that his mind has become asankata, which means unbounded, unconditioned, deconditioned. he's stopped binding his experience up with the notion of I and mine. Experience unfolds because while he's got a body, experience will unfold, but it's not seized upon, it's not grasped, it's completely open. It's completely without that identification. So that is bodhicitta. In a single understanding, that is bodhicitta. The Buddha has let go of the idea that I am found within the elements of my experience. He's let go of the idea that there are within my experience, or there is within experience, that which is mine. It's as simple as that, and as difficult as that. The Buddha has simply stopped doing it. He says, doesn't he, in that famous Song of Victory, many a rebirth have I undergone, wandering in samsara, seeking the builder of this house. No longer will you build me a house of pain. You are seen, because the mind has been unconditioned. The mind has been unbound. So it's this drive for an identity, for to be identified as something and to have something connected with one. It's gone. He's seen through it. He's seen that it's entirely without reality. In reality in the sense of any permanent abiding existence. It's a conditioned process. And, you know, I've looked at that conditioned process from an evolutionary point of view. The Buddha doesn't do that because that's not the language that was available to him. He looks at it more from the point of view of rebirth. I believe in both, actually. I think we're heirs to both processes. He's seen that process. In other words, he felt, identified very deeply that urge to be an I, to be something, to find something that's me. He's seen it absolutely plain, seen through it, so that it no longer happens. It's been dissipated. A bit like, sometimes very small things. You know, I remember giving up smoking many years ago. And you remember with smoking, well, sorry, you maybe don't remember with smoking, but if you smoked, the urge for a cigarette goes on for quite a long time. And to begin with, you find yourself reaching for a cigarette and so forth. But a certain point comes when you realise, sort of, I don't actually want a cigarette. It's not actually, something I want or need. It's just a sort of reflex that's been set up through, the physical craving and the emotional connotation of cigarette and relaxation, ease and being cool and being a man and all that sort of thing, whatever your poison was. I don't really need that. And you can see that with many petty cravings. A sort of point comes where you're still slightly driven by the habit, but you're actually not really driven, you're not really identified with it. It's just that it's still sort of there because it's been happening for so long. Your hand automatically reaches out for the cigarettes when they're on the table. And you think, oh no, actually I don't want one. You can think of many things like that. So this is the very deepest level of that. The very, very deepest level of that. It's craving itself. The craving for an identity. To be something. To be somebody. But it's just lost it. It's gone. And what emerges then is a completely new kind of awareness. It's not, in a way, to say a new kind of awareness puts it wrongly, because it's not really awareness, it's just awareness. It's a different way of interpreting awareness. Do you see what I mean? When you're aware, you're just aware. But what happens to us is immediately that awareness is overlaying by attachment immediately. Attachment, in a way, in a quite neutral sense. I don't mean, you know, a slobbering, jabbering craving in the sense of I've got to have it. Just an automatic underlying process of identity seeking. It's just there. It's a craving at that level. In Yogacara, they distinguish between two kinds of problem, as it were. One is the it's the obscuration of passion, which is called a defilement. So negative mental states, they defile your mind. But there's another kind of obscuration, which is simply the obscuration of misreading your experience. The obscuration that comes because you identify your experience with I and mine. So experience itself is innocent. Consciousness itself, in a way, you could say, is innocent. There's just awareness. But immediately we overlay onto that awareness a grasping onto a self and a mind. So the Buddha has got a completely new way of being aware. It's the same old awareness. It's not that suddenly, you know, flying saucers descend and bright lights go off. And, sorry, my imagination doesn't reach very far, does it? But it's nothing sort of, it's not like you suddenly enter a new realm. It's just that the whole world is the whole world, but seen without that contamination of I and mine. You'll never enjoy the world aright until the sea itself floweth in your veins and you are clothed with the stars and crowned with the heavens. This is Thomas Traherne, a great English mystic, speaking about that experience of letting go of identity. So it's yes, he speaks of it there in that poem in highly symbolic terms. But it's the world, but the world without I, without mine, and therefore fresh, sparkling, clear, intimate, and whole. So this is the new kind of consciousness, or new way of being consciousness, that the Buddha realized at Bodh Gaya 2,500 plus years ago, that we could refer to as bodhicitta, that entered the world through the Buddha at that time, and that he communicated, all his teaching was an attempt to communicate that way of being consciousness, of being conscious. His was his attempt to get his auditors to set aside their instinctive way of looking and to just see, free from I and mine. And to see that free from I and mine, all suffering stops. Yes, you know, thorns still hurt you. Cut me, I bleed, and so on. But no mental disturbance, no deep sense of dissatisfaction, a sense of complete ease and harmony all the time, even in the midst at times of acute pain. The Buddha, after all, suffered very badly at the end of his life, but they say sometimes in the suttas about some of the arahats that they're experiencing a pain that is bitter, sharp, and grievous, but it does not touch, in Woodward's translation, the calm core of their minds. So the Buddha's mind is free. While he's got a body, physical pain is still there. So the Buddha tried to communicate that state of consciousness that was utterly free from all kinds of mental pain, and that even made physical pain entirely bearable, just something there as part of the field of consciousness. He succeeded. Brothers, he succeeded. He managed to communicate his experience. He managed to communicate bodhicitta. And he managed to communicate it through 2,500 years till it came to us. I don't know why, how we've come to deserve it, but it came to us. It came to us, of course, certainly for me, it came to me through Urgyen Sangharakshita. I picked it up from him to the extent that I have picked it up. I sensed it. I felt it to some extent, at least at times. I participated in it to some extent at times. My own consciousness, as it were, merged with it at times. And Sangharakshita himself, of course, well, he derived it from the Buddha, but especially he says that he in a way decisively connected with it through his Bodhisattva ordination on the 12th of October 1962 in the old Bhutan Palace in Kalimpong from Dada Rinpoche, who he revered as a living Bodhisattva. He says he'd come to know Dada Rinpoche very well. He'd seen him in many situations, and he'd seen him embodying in all those situations all the paramitas. And in Dada Rinpoche, he saw the exemplification of the ideal that he'd first encountered through the works of especially Shantideva, Shiksu Samuchaya, and Bodhicharya Avatara. He came to see them embodied in Dada Rinpoche in a particularly vital and living way. He said his other teachers embodied that too, but he'd come into a more close and intimate connection with Dada Rinpoche, so that it was from him that he wanted to take the Bodhisattva vow. And remember, Bhante says that you can't take the vow merely as a wish. Do you know what I mean? We might have an idea of the bodhicitta as being something very desirable, so we want to achieve it. But you can only take the bodhisattva vow when, to some extent, that bodhicitta, as it were, is expressing itself through you. That the bodhisattva vow is the expression directly of an awakened mind. To some extent. There's no sense in the bodhisattva vows if you haven't at least the taste of the bodhicitta in your mouth. And so that means that when he took that, and Bhante's a very scrupulous man in that way, he must have felt that, well, he could take it. And he has embodied that in this order and movement that he's founded. In fact, as he famously said, and as I've quoted in that paper on the suprapersonal force, that it wasn't so much that he founded the order and movement, but that they were founded through him by what he could only describe as a suprapersonal force. We're going to explore this much more in the next days, but I think that there's little doubt that what he meant was bodhicitta, something that was not merely personal, that expressed itself through him, and that, to me, is the living essence of what we are, and of what you who've asked for ordination have seeked to link yourselves for the rest of your lives, plural, that those of us who have been ordained have inextricably linked our lives with forever, whether you like it or not. Even if you leave the order, that will still be with you, and you'll be back. I strongly believe that. In fact, I think that we should have much, much greater confidence in that spirit. You know, we've been through some strange and rocky times recently where, rightly, we've had to rethink about our own history. Very difficult process, of course, because we're looking at history from the present. And the present looking at the past is never actually looking at the past. It's looking at our recreation of the past in the present. Anyway, we won't get too philosophical about that. I find it strange because I was there, and it wasn't quite like it seems when people talk about it now. Which isn't to say that we don't need to look at it and we don't need to learn from it. But we've been through some odd times, and people have said some odd things, some quite extreme things at times. But to be honest, I've stopped being that bothered by it. Thank goodness. Because when you're bothered by it, you know, panic. Where's Sir? Oh, there he is. Panic. Panic. You know, you really fear you're going to lose it all. You're going to lose it all. Bodhicitta's not that easily lost. Bodhicitta's something much, much bigger than us. Much bigger than our petty little foibles and mistakes. So, you know, bad as they are, and much as they need to be confessed and amended and learnt from. There's something far bigger going on, brothers. Far bigger going on. And that you are trying to connect yourselves with, and that you need to have the right sort of faith in, which doesn't mean a foolish faith, oh, everything's all right because it's the suprapersonal force. Oh my goodness, I believe in fairies too. But it's an intelligent faith, a faith that accepts that the world of history never lives up to the ideal world of the bodhicitta, if you see what I mean. But that bodhicitta is never going to be lost. I'm completely confident of that. Once it's been unleashed amongst a sufficient number of people, it cannot be lost so easily. And it will be revived again and again. So, yes, I hope you've got at least an initial grasp of what it is that is our subject. This totally new kind of consciousness that emerged into human history 2,500 plus years ago, that has been continuously caught. You know, Bhante says religion cannot be taught, it has to be caught. Well, you could say that more especially of bodhicitta. It can't be taught. You can be taught how to get out of its way and where to look to find it, but in the end, it's something that you have to catch. You have to feel, you have to sense that is there as something far greater. I believe I experienced it on that, even that first evening when I listened to the White Lotus Sutra series. And in all my contact with Bhante, that's come more and more vividly alive to me. And you catch it. All you need to do is let yourself absorb it more and more fully, or absorb yourself more and more fully into it. So that's what we're going to be talking about. We're going to be talking more about what it means. We'll talk tomorrow more about what it means to let go of self. And, you know, in a way, that's talking in negative terms. Perhaps I hope sufficiently vividly for you to get some feeling for what I'm talking about. But it's not merely to be talked of in negative terms. Something comes into existence that is extraordinarily positive, to use such a limited term. And so we'll be trying to approach what the Bodhisattva ideal is about from these more positive terms. But at least to begin with, let's say that we've seen where it comes into the world, how it's connected with us, how it's communicated to us. We've seen how it is so different from our normal way of experiencing. It's not to say that from time to time we do not touch upon it. Whether you're Buddhist or not, it's not a Buddhist thing, if you like. It's part of reality. It's reality. And at times people do rise to it. Something far more deeply interfused, you know, and so on. The poets speak of it so often. We may all have experienced moments when we're released from self, when we're released from that tyranny of self. But with the Buddha, that is, as it were, stabilized and made conscious, or made consciousness is completely identified with it, and made intelligible, made articulate. And we are the heirs to that, and it is that that our whole going for refuge is directed to, and that our whole order and movement is about. So I hope that you've got something to reflect upon. I hope that in your discussions tomorrow you can reflect a little bit on whether you understand what that clinging to self means and how deep it goes. I think it's really important we see how deep it goes. Sometimes when people talk about selflessness, it's so superficial, and it really does amount to merely an intellectual, very useful, apprehension. It's so deep, it's bred into life itself. It's below the level of our conscious identity. It's bred into the very stuff of experience. So I hope you'll sort of look a little bit at what that might mean, and I hope you'll begin to look a little bit at what being released from that might mean, and I hope you'll also relate a little bit to the lineage, really, effectively, that we've got that has brought that to us, and that I guess is probably why you're all here seeking this quixotic ordination business. I take it that it's something of that kind, that transcendental dimension, that has brought you here. So I'd be very interested to hear from the group leaders eventually, when the cycle comes around to me again, just whether you've got something of what I'm talking about and whether it means something real to you. And it's so important that you do get it, because it's of the essence of what we're about. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Subhuti. I'm not even going to try and summarise. You'll be relieved to hear that. But what a start. What an incredibly exciting start to this series of talks. I mean, you know, we were actually given an evocation of the enlightened mind, the enlightened soul, provocative language. Mm-hmm. Yippee, great, fantastic, bring it on.
Yeah.
So good. So that's been opened up to us, as well as the nitty-gritty of what keeps us away from that. But what a beginning. Very, very exciting. And I can't wait for, well, the groups tomorrow, but their next talk. What's he going to do next? So thank you very, very much, Subhuti. Thank you.